While it can't be overstated that local elections have a much more direct impact on the day-to-day life of the average American, it also can't be dismissed that presidential elections capture the nation's attention in the way that isn't quite seen anywhere else. And with that being said, and with COVID still being a thing, we decided to have a show answering questions. We decided to boil those questions down to a list of 7 questions that we feel cover the bulk of all the things we were asked about, and that is going to be our show for today. Those questions are: what's the outlook given that the majority of this election will be disputed? How can Trump go straight to the Supreme Court with election issues? Why do they tell people to vote if it's based on the Electoral College and not the popular vote? Why are different networks presenting different results? Why don't black people like Biden because of the 94 crime bill? Why does his position on the 94 crime bill no longer matter? And what's the deal with masks? And is there an end in sight for COVID? So we are going to jump into all of those topics, but first we got to do what we got to do.
This is Lessons from the screen. John Boy.
Welcome to Lessons from the Screen, the show where we give you a review of whether or not any particular show that you're watching or gaining information from of any particular kind, any particular information. We make sure it's worth your time. We waste our time, our energy, and our brain power so that you don't have to. And you are always welcome. Lessons from the Screen is sponsored by PACS Inc., a black activist advocacy and think tank organization with the purpose of increasing the quality of life for black Americans through educational culture shift and economics. You can check them out at www.pactsinc.org. Definitely show them love. Make sure that you support them in doing what they're trying to do, because they are supporting you in doing what you're trying to do. Some kind of way. Every kind of way. Anyways, let's jump right into it. Question number one. We are saying, what's the outlook given that the majority of this election will be disputed? Well, the outlook overall is a situation similar to what happened in the 2000 election in some regards between Bush and Gore, which was heavily disputed. And that is pretty much the regard that I'm talking about, the heavily disputed piece. But the majority of this election will not be disputed, like the Gore-Bush thing, which in our memories, Gore and Bush was heavily disputed, but really it came down to one state, the state of Florida, which really got a bad rep because there were a lot of other states that they wanted to dispute and contest, but they decided to focus all their efforts on the largest prize on the table at that time in the state that they felt like they could turn over. And that state was, unfortunately, my home state of Florida. So that's what happened. But anyways, getting back to where we're at now, the majority of this election will not be disputed. So we're going to take that word out and process the question without it, because the majority of the votes are indisputable, with only really Georgia, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and maybe Michigan being disputable states. But with the way things are looking right now, being able to dispute 2 or 3 states isn't going to matter very much because of the lead Biden has in electoral votes. And also because usually when recounts are issued, and he has asked for recounts in several states, if you're going to pick up votes, usually the ballots only change. The count only changes by a couple hundred. In this case, he would need to pick up a couple thousand votes in some of these states and as much as 20,000 in others. Picking up that many votes is just unheard of. A candidate losing that many votes or the election going in that type of direction that way is just unheard of. So good luck with that. But also the burden of proof regarding misdeeds would be on the Trump administration, which makes things even more difficult with regards to proving a case for voter fraud or other election misdeeds. If there were evidence, I'm inclined to believe that Trump would have already gone public with that. But keep in mind that we are arguing about projections right now. And just keep in mind, right? as the actual electors don't cast their vote until December, we are arguing about the projections about how they're going to vote. And as the states themselves have not finished certifying their votes, we are again arguing about projections. So just keep that in mind. But with that being said, the timeline of events thus far hasn't really been changed at all. Barring any bad faith electors or any equally egregious actions on the part of the Judiciary Committee, this will be solidified in December as usual, and the candidate will take office in January. Now, while the outlook of the election is what it is, and how that all will play out is anyone's guess right now, Trump has been extremely vague about his willingness to peacefully hand over power, and as the vote counting process draws out and the margin of victory for Joe Biden grows, he seems to be getting increasingly angry and becoming very unhinged in his attacks on the democratic process, something that has been expected. What is unexpected is how the Republican Party will act, because they have shown signs of being on both sides of the fence. Thus far, they have not necessarily been echoing all of his sentiments as much as they had during his presidency anyways. And even Fox News has taken to defending itself and siding against Trump with his latest attacks on the election process and on their news desk projecting states in favor of Joe Biden. So that provides an area of unpredictability about what's going on with regards to the Republican Party. So, but on that note, his supporters seem to be willing to do anything he asks and anything it takes to secure a victory, which is where the question becomes, where do the loyalties of his supporters truly lie? Are they Republicans at heart, or are they Trumpers at heart? And I'm not talking about his base. We know that those people are Trumpers at heart. I'm talking about the Republicans that are really only supporting him because he is the candidate of the Republican Party. And that may seem obvious to some, but the question at the heart of the matter is, how much influence does the Republican Party have? And when I say the Republican Party, I mean, how much influence does the Republican Party platform have over these people? If the platform continues to stand with the democratic process, then even a small amount of influence could cause Trump supporters to refrain from going too wild. However, if they have no influence whatsoever, or if they decide to throw their allegiance behind Trump once again, something that is looking increasingly more likely, then things could quickly escalate to a point of carnage, both literally and figuratively, with regards to lives, politics, and the foundational structures of American society. But for Black people in particular, Joe Biden's win will be a very good thing for Black people in terms of stopping the very damaging presidency of Donald Trump. But it's also not something that will herald in a new era of Black success and equality. I don't personally believe the damage that Trump has done already will be undone or even fully repaired, for that matter. In my opinion, it will more than likely be a return to the status quo, the soothing death of the culture instead of the violent death that we were headed for under Trump. Of course, Joe Biden could be a changed man. He could have learned a lot during his tenure under the Obama administration and during his time in politics, in which case we enter our best case scenario, in my opinion, and that is Black people gain an ally in the White House that sends, or at least tries to send, resources to the community that can be used by the community, but still needs work to be done by the community in order to make real change happen. That is an interesting scenario, but that's the scenario that, I, in my opinion, is the most favorable. So question two, we got, how can Trump go straight to the Supreme Court with the election issues that he's bringing forward? And the short answer to that is he most likely won't. The long answer is that it's complicated. It's always complicated. You see, the Supreme Court is granted both original and appellate jurisdiction in the U.S. Constitution. Original jurisdiction means that the Supreme Court can be the first to hear a case. Appellate means that they can review decisions from lower courts, other courts. So what we are primarily dealing with here is the question of, can the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction be manipulated in such a way that the Trump administration could bring an election suit directly to the Supreme Court? And again, the short answer is no, but the long answer is it's still a bit more nuanced in terms of potential loopholes. You see, in 1789, Congress passed the Judiciary Act of 1789, and it made the Supreme Court's original jurisdiction exclusive to suits between two or more states, a state and a foreign government, and suits against ambassadors and other public ministers. So while the Trump administration can't directly go to the Supreme Court with a case of voter fraud on a state-by-state basis, they could, in theory, go to the Supreme Court with a case of interstate travel or double-casted ballots. Interstate travel and double-casted ballots, meaning that they could, if they could, let's throw that in there. If they could credibly assert that residents from one state were traveling to another state to cast ballots, that would potentially be a case that would fit the Supreme Court's originality jurisdiction, if you twist your head and squint your eyes. Of course, the operative word there is credible, which is a tough mark to reach, and which is why the short answer to this question is that he can't do it. We can all confidently assert that any case that he pushes to the Supreme Court that makes it to the Supreme Court would no doubt lean in his direction, but getting it there would be difficult, to say the least. And the Supreme Court would need to take care that they don't destroy public opinion and public confidence in the institution of the Supreme Court. The case would have to be credible enough to give them room to move, and it is highly doubtful that something that credible will come directly from the Trump administration with regards to multi-state issues. Now, a Republican state official could bring charges against another state official on the charges of interstate election fraud that could also go to the Supreme Court. But again, the same standards for credibility would apply. And thus far, we haven't seen any indication of any standard that would achieve that level of credibility, even being in the realm of possibility right now. So the scenario that will most likely play out is that Trump will sue a state, which he's already done. He'll lose, which he's already done. He'll appeal, which he has not done yet, and work his way up to the Supreme Court in a traditional fashion, also assuming that the Supreme Court actually takes up the case. That might actually be a show on how the Supreme Court works, but that is not this show. So the states do have jurisdiction over their own affairs, and as such, each state is responsible for looking into its own election process and their results. But creativity is an intricate part of being a lawyer, and I have no doubt that the Trump lawyers can find a loophole no matter how flawed the argument may be and push it forward. But the credibility fact still comes into play, and I can't predict what sort of story or angle they're going to come up with, or if there is some old obscure loophole available. But as it stands, Trump can delay, but he can't stop the inevitable, dog. Know what I'm talking about? He can't stop it. So, question number three. Why do they tell people to vote if it's based on the Electoral College and not the popular vote? And well, there are two separate issues at play here. The first is that there is more at stake when you vote than just the presidential election. The second is that the popular vote does determine the president, just indirectly. So, to the first issue, which is simple enough, there is more at stake than just the presidency during an election year, and every election doesn't even really have the presidency on the ballot. Every 2 years, there is an election in this country, and presidents only run every 4 years. Every 2 years, however, there is all of the members of the House of Representatives on the ballot, along with 1/3 of the members of Senate. And the Senate is elected in classes. So two of the classes have 33 members. One of the classes has 34 members. Every election, one of those classes is up for election every 2 years. So, but that's on the federal level. On the local level, you have any number of elections from school board to city council to judges to dog catchers to morticians, depending on how your local politics is set up. But in addition to that, you have referendums, policies, all sorts of other goodies that affect your local life, finances, and relationships in any number of ways, from local minimum wage increases to curfews to the length of office of a local official. All of these things and more can be found on the ballot during any given election year. And all of these things are determined purely by the popular vote. So yes, your vote is vitally important towards the governance of your area and how you live in that area. But with all that out of the way, let's clear up the mess on how the election process works for presidents, because that's something that really needs to be done on a national level, and news broadcast needs to stop broadcasting the popular vote in the way that they do, because it leads to false narratives and misunderstandings. So the political parties chooses their own set of electors, and the Democrats choose their electors and the Republicans choose their electors. Now, these electors are separate electors, and like I said, they are chosen by each party for each state, and the amount chosen are equal to the state's electoral college votes, which are determined proportionally by the number of the states, by the population of the states, excuse me. So the larger states have more electors than smaller states, and this number is equal to the legislative delegates that each state has, which is an easy way to remember how many electoral college votes there are in total. There are 535 voting representatives in total in Congress, 435 in the House, 100 in the Senate. A large state like California, which has 53 congressional districts, means that it has 53 people representing the state in the House of Representatives, and it has 2 people representing it in the Senate. All of the states have 2 people representing them in the Senate. So this equals out to a total federal delegation of 55 members, and as such, the state has 55 electoral votes. See how that works? So, which is also why California is such a high-priced state in terms of winning that state. But like I said before, all states have 2 representatives in the Senate. So really the differentiation comes in the House of Representatives. That's where the size of states in terms of population becomes a thing that comes into play. And it is what balances out Congress as a whole. But getting into a conversation about how Congress works is a bit outside the scope of this show, and I just wanted to mention that because one argument used against the Electoral College and the 2-chamber Congress is that states like Delaware have the same amount of representatives as a huge state like California, which is true in the Senate, but not in the House. Delaware has 1 representative in the House compared to California's 53. And certainly not where the Electoral College is concerned, where Delaware has 3 electors and California has 55. So this is also one of the reasons why census participation is so important, because the amount of representatives and thus the electoral weight of a state is determined by the 10-year census. So moving forward, when you cast your vote on a presidential election, coming off of that long tangent, what you are actually voting for is which party's electors will get the chance to vote during the Electoral College ceremony in December for your state, which is something else that the popular votes that displayed on TV actually messes up. It causes people to forget or to misunderstand or become disillusioned by what's happening. The only popular vote totals that matter are within the state itself. When you cast your ballot, you are casting your ballot as a block with the rest of the people in your state when it comes to the presidency. So If the majority of the people in your state vote Democrat, they will win the popular presidential election in your state, and their electors get to vote during the ceremony in December, most likely for their party. And this is the way it works in every state except Maine and Nebraska, who use a proportional system instead of a winner-take-all system that's used in every other state. Maine became proportional in 1972, and Nebraska became proportional in 1996. Now, in some states, electors are required to vote the direction of the popular vote. But there are very few states with actual penalties for if an elector votes against the will of the people or the party that selected them. This is a rare occasion because parties themselves pick the electors and are not likely to pick someone that may be shaky on voting for the party. But yes, your vote absolutely counts directly in terms of everything but the presidency, and indirectly in terms of the presidency. Those people that are saying your vote doesn't count because of the Electoral College are wrong. The electoral system could be enhanced. I believe that if they made the entire system proportional instead of winner take all, it would be more indicative of the popular vote more often than not. But the problem here is not the system itself. It is the narrative created by the uninformed masses and by the misguided media, who constantly show the popular vote totals for the nation up on the screen as if that actually means something. This is a case where too many stats, too much statistics, too many numbers, numbers that don't mean anything, actually hurt instead of help. Don't pay attention to the national totals. Pay attention to the state totals. Those are the only numbers that matter in terms of the popular vote for the election and in terms of the vote for anything else that may or may not be going on in your state and in your locality. Popular vote is what matters in your state. So just pay attention to that. So moving on, we have question number four. Why are the different networks presenting different results? And it's because they're all projections. The states don't certify their results for weeks, and the Electoral College doesn't cast their votes until December. The Associated Press is considered to be the gold standard, with several newsrooms and even Google utilizing their account. But most of the big newsrooms and the big networks have their own metrics and standards for making declarations based on previous results, current climate, and their own secret sauce, whatever that might be. So nobody wants to go on hand to say that a state has won, only to have that state actually go the other way in the real world. So they all have different measures and standards for when they declare a state. So the threshold might be met by one network, but not met by another network, which results in the numbers being different depending on where you look. So this question five, is an interesting question because it's a question that actually comes up a lot by people that are just curious about what's going on but haven't necessarily started doing their own digging yet, or maybe they have been doing digging, just not in this area. But the question is, why don't black people like Biden because of the 94 crime bill? And this is a story, so bear with me, although admittedly I'm going to leave a lot of stuff out because, like I said, this is a story. This is probably going to be his own show at some point, and I'm going to even say that it's going to be his own show probably multiple times during this story. But here we go. The 94 crime bill was a bill that was passed into law in 1994 during the Clinton administration. Now, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994, which is what it was called, was put into law in order to reverse the rising crime wave in the late 80s and early 90s. And it's easy to forget how bad things were in the 90s. This was the time period during which the city of Chicago earned its deadly reputation, as the violent crime statistics were more than two times as bad as they are in this current era. But all across the country, violent crime and drug addiction was running rampant through poor communities, particularly black communities. And the tough on crime rhetoric was the political message of the day for any politician that wanted to be elected. Everyone, black, white, Democrat, Republican, Asian, alien, Martian, Venetian, whatever you want, solar, stellar body, whatever you want to call it. All right, third eye blind, all of these people, all of them, third eye woke, calcified, blinking, RGB, all of these people, if they wanted to be elected during that time period, they ran on a platform of being tough on crime. But the political realities of the time, as well as the actual effects of the law, have largely been ignored in today's discussions about the law and those who crafted and signed it. But enough foreplay. Let's get specifically into the issue that the black community has. And the black community views the crime bill as the reason for the destruction of the community in the 90s and the mass incarceration numbers we see today. And if you ask most black people that attack Biden, the Clintons, or the Democrats as a whole about the 94 crime bill, at some point in that answer, it will be spoken as if it will be spoken of as if it is the single largest factor in the destruction of the black community in modern times. And the crime bill did a lot. There's a lot in it, but there are three things to address here, roughly three things to address here. One of which has already been addressed, which was the times during the early 90s. As mentioned before, crime was rampant and had been on the upswing for a while, with the crack epidemic continuing to roll through the community. And I know some of you are thinking right now about the government and Central America and Freeway Rick Ross, but that's another show. But the fact is that the crime was so bad that black political leaders, activists, and cultural icons were all singing the same tune and demanding the government do something about crime and drugs in black communities. They felt like the communities were under attack. And even the people that were woke at the time, quote unquote woke, at the time, view what was happening in the community as a government-sanctioned attack on the community, especially with the drugs in the community. So everyone was singing a tune of something needed to be done about crime in the communities. And a lot of these people were looking towards the government. So that's the first thing that needs to be understood with regards to the climate going on at that time. The second thing is the politics of the government's response, which was the 94 crime bill. And that bill was, in the truest sense of the word, a compromise between all political parties involved. And being the compromise that it was, it didn't really make anyone happy. And that's how politics in America used to work. In order for a bill to become law, it had to have some level of bipartisan support. That's the way things used to happen. In the case of this bill, the Democrats got money for social programs, alternatives to incarcerations, including $33 billion to hire 100,000 more police officers across the nation, as well as provisions for violence against women. And in the case of Republicans, they got money to give states that built more prisons and increased their incarceration rates. And federal mandatory minimums were also bumped into this and notched up a notch, because federal mandatory minimums were already in place prior to the 94 crime bill. But the 94 crime bill kind of increased their usage rate, their utility, shall we say. And what's interesting, and it also introduced the three strikes rule, which Biden is on record as disagreeing with at the time, and the notorious crack powder disparity regarding cocaine. And while people like Maxine Waters did vote against the bill, she is on record as voting against the bill because of the changes to death row, making it easier for people to be placed on death row. But many Republicans also voted no because the bill came with an assault rifle ban, which was one of the big reasons why the Democrats did so bad in the 1994 election, losing control of Congress for the first time in 40 years. The first time in 40 years that they lost control of Congress, they did so because of the passage of the 94 crime bill and the assault weapons ban. But that's something else to consider, because when the Democrats lost control of Congress, the Republicans took office. And that has also affected our memory, because the Republicans removed a lot of the social programs and beefed up some of the punitive programs following the 94 crime bill before those things could even really take hold, take effect, and take shape in any sort of way. So the politics of the situation move along another route, because Democrats had also been getting beat over the head politically for being soft on crime. They were losing a lot of political capital because the Republican Party were beating them over the head about being soft on crime. And Bill Clinton, along with other congressional Democrats, saw this bill as a way to swing the narrative in the other direction. Now, although I'm sure many of them actually thought that they were doing something helpful, white effects, regardless of intentionality, is another show that we probably need to get into, because a lot of times these well-meaning white folk be fucking shit up. There ain't no other way to say it. But anyways, moving on. The politics of the situation, we have to remember how the government works, right? Federal policy encourages states to move in a certain direction, but coloring and enforcing federal policy is still very much under the domain of the state. Many states took these opportunities to pass stricter state laws, and many of these governors, mayors, and state legislators were also black, further showcasing the politics of the time and how different they are from today. So, and keep in mind, like, this has always been this issue of racial oppression in America has always been an issue that white supremacists and white racial radicals and alt-righters and all of these guys have always wanted to champion it as a states' right issue. The federal government would do one thing, the states would take what the federal government has done and interpret it in their own ways, usually in a way that was not very beneficial for black people. So the states' right argument still comes into play here, because federal policy was established. And when you read through the 94 crime bill, you can actually read what was attempting to be accomplished, but not giving the federal government no slack, because again, this needs to be its own show. Just want to point out the fact that the states took what was put on the table with the 94 crime bill. They colored it, they dressed it up, and they made it what it became. So, but with all that being said, Joe Biden, in addition to writing a large chunk of the bill, also celebrated its passage and bragged about it, calling it the Biden crime bill during the election of 2008. So that's also something that can't necessarily be forgotten about. But the third point I mentioned here is the culture of the community at that time. There are documented reports of black people supporting the legislation. The legislation had black support. I'm gonna say that again another way, like I just did. Black people wanted something done, and at that time, a large portion of the black community was in favor of mandatory minimums and anything that got what we ourselves considered as bad elements out of the community. We asked for the crime bill. We begged for the crime bill, and many of us rejoiced in its passing, and not in the Democratic or socialist components of it, but in the punitive Republican conservative components of it. The crime bill in actuality could be a show, and it will be a show, because it should be a show in and of itself, and probably look, if you're listening to this, I'm leaving a lot out when I'm talking about this crime bill. You definitely need to do your research or wait for me to do a longer show specifically dedicated to it, but those are the reasons why black people don't like the crime bill, and that's my view on what the crime bill was. I wanted to address my view on what it was, because I feel like just talking about why black people hate the crime bill and attach Joe Biden to it does not really get at the heart of what's really being discussed, which is also something that's also going to be touched on in this very next question. So, question number six, why does his position in the 94 crime bill no longer matter? And it's not that his position on the crime bill no longer matters, it's that our view of the crime bill has been rewritten. And I'm not shy about saying that, as in my opinion, I'm not shy about saying that it has been rewritten through Republican talking points aimed at the Clintons and the Democratic establishment. And this is shown in who we hold accountable for it. Republicans also voted for the 94 crime bill. They voted in support of it. And as I mentioned earlier, a lot of the punitive aspects of the crime bill that we hate, such as the increase in the amount of prisons and incarcerations, was put into the crime bill as a means to satisfy Republicans. But Republicans don't face flack for the crime bill. The Democrats do. And specifically, the Clintons do. And now that Joe Biden is running and has become president-elect, Joe Biden is, although as soon as he announced that he was running and became a threat, he was. Everyone that becomes a threat to the Republican establishment has had to contend with the issue of the 94 crime bill if they were in public light during the 90s. And I say in public light because Hillary Clinton was the first lady. She had no power to pass legislation, but she was still blamed for the 94 crime bill. But Bernie Sanders, who voted for it, has not had to answer for his vote in any meaningful fashion. He has said that he voted for it because of the provisions regarding violence against women, but no one is really taking him to task in the same way that they taken Biden or the Clintons to task. And let's face it, the Republican establishment really hates the Clintons. They have spent decades attacking them, and I'm not saying I'm a fan of the Clintons by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm also not a pawn of the Republican propaganda machine, and a lot of the things created in that machine seem to find their way into the black community. But to the point of specified hatred, the Black Political Caucus also supported the 94 crime bill, with all but 10 of their members voting in favor of it, and many prominent black leaders, both in and out of politics, celebrated the passing of the crime bill. None of them have faced backlash either. This specified and directed hatred at a few people, and only when they become a threat to the Republican establishment, is why I say that the Republicans have infected the community with this narrative. I don't believe that it is a view that is intrinsic to the community. If it was a view that wasn't inserted into the community, if it was a view that was naturally evolving, then the hatred, the animosity would be spread out over the entire political establishment and the entire cultural and political leadership landscape of the black community. But that has not happened, which again is why I'm saying that I think that this position that many black people have, whether they realize it or not, is actually a position of the conservative propaganda machine that has found its way into the very fertile ground of the black community, which already distrusts the government. But the other, and rightfully so, I distrust the government myself, not even going front. But the other issue is that the 94 crime bill was not the driving force for community destruction that we have been led to believe it was. Mass incarceration started in the 60s, but black people had always been incarcerated at a rate 7 to 10 times that of whites. In the 80s, with the spread of crack through black communities, there was an uptick of black incarcerations. This is something that can't be rolled off or ignored. So when we talk about the dramatic effects of mass incarceration on the community, we can't speak from the standpoint of the damage it did without first accounting for the damage that was already being done and that would have continued to be done regardless of whether or not the crime bill passed. And as I said earlier, mass incarceration had already been underway for 30 years before the 94 crime bill. But the 94 crime bill did cause an increase in incarcerations. However, that increase wasn't solely, predominantly, or focused on the black community. In 1993, there were 1,500 black inmates per 1,000 black people, compared to 210 white inmates per 100,000 white people. In 2011, there were 500 white male inmates for every 100,000 white males in the regular population, and there were 3,000 black male inmates for every 100,000 black males in population. The actual numbers work out to a 106% increase in the number of black men incarcerated versus a 131% increase in the number of white men incarcerated. And we look at the men because the common argument is that black men were targeted and systemically removed from the community after the 94 crime bill. Now, while it is true that the 94 crime bill did increase the incarceration rates in the community, it did not do it, and I'm going to say this again and again, it did not It did not do anything different or new, and it did not specifically target the black community in any meaningful way that was not already underway. Black prisoners made up roughly half of all prisoners before the bill passed, and right now they still make up roughly half of all prisoners. The sinister effects attributed to the 94 crime bill actually predate the law itself, and that is something that has to be reconciled with our memory of events. There are valid arguments as to why someone could and should hold the crime bill against politicians, and those arguments are not specific to the Clintons and now the Bidens. They are specific to the Democratic Party either. They aren't even really specific to white people, because we got to remember we asked for this. Even those that voted against the bill, most of them did not do so because they saw the damage that it would do to the community. They did so because there was something else in the bill that they rejected. And Biden, as well as the Clintons, are the only ones out of all of the politicians thus far to apologize, for whatever that's worth. It's not worth too much to me, but it's worth something to somebody. But the point of reference here is simply that this was an all-around bad situation, and if we're going to hold one person's feet to the fire, we should hold everyone's feet to the fire, and we definitely shouldn't be allowing the Republican Party to score points of something they helped pass and actually made worse. That's my position on the 94 crime bill. Yes, it was bad, but if Joe Biden is catching them hands for it, all of the political establishment should catch hands for it. What Trump has done during his time in office has actually been worse than the 94 crime bill was. He should definitely not be allowed to score political points off of it. And black leaders and black activists at the time should not be allowed to skate free. We have got to remember these events the way they actually happened, so that we don't find ourselves back in this situation again. We begged for the 94 crime bill. We begged for it. And then we got it and we celebrated it. And now, years later, we want to change the way we view it. That is going to put us in a situation to where we're going to be begging for something else. We're already begging for other things. And those situations where you're begging and demanding and praying for somebody else to do something for you, those are not situations that are going to end up in your best benefit, especially when you look at the history that we have here in this country. We've got to remember that we asked for that and we got what we asked for and we celebrated it when we got it. Let's stop holding one person accountable and hold everybody accountable, and let's especially not let racists, white supremacists, and any of these other nefarious actors score political points, score brownie points off of it and sway us to their sides and their arguments because of it, because they voted for it too and they made it worse. So again, to answer the question, it's not that his position on the crime bill no longer matters. In my opinion, it's that we've kind of got to fix the way we remember the crime bill. It's funny how different our memory of it is versus the actual events and the way they actually played out. But go and read it. Even if you do wait for me to do a long form show on it, go and read that bill. And the final question for this show: what's the deal with masks, and is there an end in sight for COVID? Actually, yes, there is an end in sight for COVID. Just earlier this week, it was announced that Pfizer, I believe was the company, has a cure that is 90% effective against COVID, a vaccine that's 90% effective against COVID. And that is expected to be brought to market sometime in the next few months. I don't know. But there is an end in sight for it. COVID is an interesting case. because it didn't have to be this bad. And this is one of the reasons why I say Donald Trump has been disastrous for the black community, because a lot of the damage could have been prevented. And even after it occurred, a lot of the damage that's been focused in the black community could have been prevented. So, and this is not just a slap against Donald Trump. This is a slap against, again, the entire political establishment, as well as the cultural icons in the black community who have not done, in my opinion, any sort of righteous justice or anything that helps the black community. And this also goes to a lot of other pseudo intellectuals and nonprofit organizations that wanted to do work in the black community without taking the necessary precautions to make sure that spread was controlled. There are a lot of reasons why this thing is as bad as it's been and why it continues to get worse. And a lot of that is simply because people don't want to do what they need to do. They just don't want to. It's not that they don't know, they just don't want to. And it doesn't hit home for people until it hits their home and they lose people. Or they experience the negative aspects of it in such a way that even if there wasn't a death, the alterations of their lifestyles and the people that they love, the people that they care about, is so dramatic that it forces them to reevaluate the situation. That is why COVID is as bad as it is, and that's why it continues to be as bad as it continues to be. So, but there is an end in sight for COVID. There is light at the end of the tunnel. Eventually, COVID will go away. The question for me is just how many people are going to die or have their lives permanently altered by it. How many of these people... COVID is a very frustrating case for me right now. But the deal with the mask is that the masks don't prevent you from getting COVID. And this has been said time and time again. What the masks actually do, and I've actually said this during shows, what the masks actually do is prevent you from spreading COVID if you have COVID. If you have COVID, the mask will stop you from giving it to other people. If you don't have COVID, the masks really don't do anything for you. I mean, they are a barrier to prevent infection, but they don't stop infection from spreading in such a way that they could be recommended to stop the spread in an area that doesn't have COVID cases. Again, what they do is they stop you from giving it to other people. COVID spreads through water droplets, liquid vapors, droplets, things that float through the air, mucus, various other things. So when you have a mask on, typically most of the moisture we expel from our bodies comes from our mouth and our nose. When we sneeze, when we cough, when we breathe out, when we're doing all of these things, and those particles, that moisture that comes out of our facial orifices are filled with COVID. Well, if you have a mask on, all of that stuff gets caught in the mask. So you're the only person breathing in your nasty COVID air. That's how it works. It's literally just that simple. Which is why it's interesting to me that people are saying that I'm not going to wear a mask because it doesn't stop me from getting COVID. That is extremely selfish. And extremely selfish. Like, it's not about you. It's about the next person. And that is also something that we're seeing here, even when it comes to the schools reopening. Everybody's like, the kids are healthy, they bounce back quickly. Yes, they may be, but what about the parents that they infect, the grandparents that they infect, the neighbors that they infect, the friends and families, those families that they infect, the teachers that they infect, who also have families that could be infected? It's almost like we don't understand how pandemics work, how epidemics work, how viruses work, how diseases spread. And that's a problem. But this is not a show about COVID. Just answering the question. So that's the deal with masks. Yes, there is an end in sight for COVID. Unfortunately, I don't think that end is going to arrive until there have been millions dead, which were millions dead and hundreds of millions infected. and tens of millions negatively impacted permanently for the rest of their lives. I think that is where we are with COVID. And it's sad, it's despicable, it's discouraging, especially knowing that all of this, all of it, could have been prevented. That's what's going on with COVID. So I want to thank you guys for listening, for tuning in. I know this show was a little bit longer than usual. We're trying some new things, trying some new setups. I'm not going to say you're going to see any of them, because they might not actually come out, depending on how it is when we look back at it and try to edit it and play around with some things. But we try some new things, and we're constantly trying to try new things. But definitely let your friends know. Check out the podcast, check out the YouTube channel, links will be everywhere. Tell your friends to tell a friend. Subscribe if you're listening to the podcast. Subscribe and make sure that you're listening to every show. If you're listening to this on YouTube, because we put out a YouTube video, definitely subscribe to the YouTube channel. Hit the bell. We're going to be trying to go live more often, and I look forward to seeing you Friday, because we're not doing Saturday and Wednesdays anymore. We are now going to be doing Tuesdays and Fridays, as we, like I said, we changing things up. We trying to figure out what works better. So I'm Patrick Irvin. This is Lesson from the Screen. Thank you for tuning in. See you next show.
This is Lesson from the screen. John Boy.
So once again, I want to thank you guys for listening and supporting. Remember to share the shows with your friends, with your families, have conversations, and have conversations with me as well. Give me feedback on what you think about the shows. Definitely the place that you can find all of the shows is going to be the Freedom Train website, www.freedomtrainradio.com. Look for the Lesson from the Screen tab. Be sure to support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/LFTS. And you can find some of the videos that we're going to be dropping on YouTube, on the Freedom Train Network's YouTube channel. You can also support us by going and purchasing the book, The Chasm by Patrick Irvin. You can find it on Amazon, or you can find it on my personal website, www.patrickbirvin, that's patrickbirvin.com. You'll find The Chasm there. Definitely support us. You can reach me always through internet or through email, patrick@freedomtrainnetwork.com. And be sure, last but not least, be sure to go to the Google Play Store if you have an Android device and get that Freedom Train Network app, and that'll give you access to all of the shows up to date. You don't have to search, you don't have to, you get automatically notified, and that is the best way to support us and stay in touch with us. Definitely check the website if you are interested in becoming a podcaster, if you are a black podcaster that already has a show or is interested in joining the network. We'll take you. Even if you don't want to join the network, you can definitely go to the website and submit, and we are anxious and looking forward to and excited to work with you. Catch you guys on the next show.